Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and we're at the interview part of the show. Today, we've got an author. He's written quite a few books, and there's a few that are really interest me because they kind of cover in history and death. And so joining us, we've got Jeff MacArthur. Thanks for being here, Jeff.
Thank you for having me.
Some of your books now, the one Two Gun Heart and the other one, Dirty Old War, like both really interest me. How do you get to where you were actually writing about these subjects, because they're both kind of, you know, nonfiction, true accounts, and a little bit more serious than, you know, than a lot of writing out there. So what drew you to that?
Well, you know, the way I got into writing the Two Gun Heart story was like basically a fluke. My father just kind of casually one day told me about how the largest bank robbery in history took place in our hometown of Lincoln, Nebraska. And that Al Capone's long-lost brother, who was a lawman in the area, helped get the money back. And he just kind of casually said that to me, like it was just a piece of conversation, and I just went, wait, what? Tell me about this? And he was like, oh, yeah, I guess I should have asked my dad more about that while he was still alive. But unfortunately, my grandfather had died by that point, and he's the one who had told my dad, so, you know, he just didn't have any information. So over the next several years, I kept asking my dad to look into it. And finally, one day, I just went ahead and just looked at, there was another book about Al Capone that mentioned the brother. So, and it said that he lived in Homer, Nebraska, which is a tiny little town about 3 hours north of Lincoln, where we were. And we were like, you know, I bet somebody up there knows about him. So we literally just took this long 3-hour trip just on faith, thinking, well, there'll probably be somebody, you know, like usually there's like a little bar there or whatever. The stereotype is true. You go in there, you know, and we asked about him, and they were like, oh, so-and-so knew about him. There's this little lady working in the back, comes out, yeah, and in fact, one of his relatives is coming in a few minutes, and because he comes in, like, he came in every day to play dominoes or something like that, and he came up to us, and first thing he said was, so you know, he's a Capone, and we're like, yeah, you know, we're that's what we're kind of fascinated by, and he said, well, unfortunately, he's not around here anymore. He's a long ways away. He's in Lincoln. We go all the way back there, look in the phone book. Turns out he lives pretty much around the corner from my dad. It was Richard Hart's son, or Al Capone's long-lost brother, whose real name was Vincenzo, went by the name Richard Hart. And his son, Harry Hart, was living around the corner. I called him up. His answering machine just was literally, I got the answering machine, and it was literally him saying, This is Harry Hart, son of Two Gun Hart. And he had been waiting for all those years for somebody to come along and help tell his story. So I became fascinated in terms of that, started talking to him about it. They were very wary because so many people have taken any stories about the Capones and really exploited them. And it's, you know, from the beginning, he's like, I don't have any illusions about my uncle. I know the things he did, but there's more to our family and nobody's ever been interested. So, you know, I said I was much more interested. And at that time, I was more into trying to make movies than I was into books. But it slowly kind of morphed into this because I realized how, well, for several reasons, but mainly I just realized just how good of a story this was and how much you could really fulfill. I know that's more of an answer than you're asking, but that's kind of how that one came about. And then the sister book, The Great Heist, also came about that sort of way. Then with Dirty Old War, it was a completely different way. After I was done with this, I wanted to do something else. Like, I did three books about my home state of Nebraska in a row. And so I wanted to do something, you know, out more in the world. And I knew somebody. Oh, wait, no, it was, I found out about somebody who was a survivor from South Vietnam who had come to the U.S. And his story, I was just like, nobody knows the stories of the South Vietnamese soldiers. We've heard about the Viet Cong, even the North Vietnamese are, you know, the enemies. And of course, we know a million stories about the U.S. as if it was our war, but it was really their war. And it was really a war in trying to defend this, you know, burgeoning country of South Vietnam. Whatever one's opinions are, positive or negative, whatever, that's really what they were at least fighting for, was for their burgeoning nation. And so I was like, what's the story here? So I started trying to learn about that. And as I was trying to learn that, I befriended somebody who was an American soldier. And I was less interested in that story because it's like so many books have been done about that. But his story was so amazing. Like, there were so many different aspects to it. I'm like, you know, you hear about, there's always been sort of one side said about it of just the horrors of war. And not that that shouldn't be told, but there's just a lot of interesting things, a lot of things that just you wouldn't expect. And the more I talked to him and the more I talked to another friend, another person I got to know who was an American soldier, I just started realizing from all these different perspectives, there are these really amazing stories, both in regards to the horror of war, but also just in regards to just fascinating. So I just started going, you know, I'd really like to do something next on just the different points of view of this war. Just real quick as well, throw in this as well. Probably the most bizarre of those stories, because as I was writing this, there was a friend of ours, my girlfriend and I, this friend of ours named Miju, we have known for years. And one day while waiting outside of a taco place for her boyfriend's birthday, he just starts joking about how she's a princess. And then he goes, yeah, no, she's an actual princess. And we're like, what? Yeah, oh yeah, right. Because, you know, Miju is very much a princess. He goes, no, she's actual royalty of South Vietnam. And I went, wait, what? And turned out that there was a royal family of Vietnam that they had abdicated the throne, but they still kept track of who the royal family was and everything. And they had a whole story of escape from South Vietnam. So, and they had also been waiting for all this time to have their stories told. So that's the thing. I'm always fascinated by these stories that are, they've not been told. They're like on the cusp of something we've heard about, but it's a different angle, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. But I would think that I've done quite a few nonfiction true crime books, but I would think that especially the war book, it would be kind of emotional in a bit, wouldn't it, to write something like that, to get these stories?
It was, but you know, I mean, it was weird. I actually mentioned to my girlfriend, and excuse me if this is a little TMI, but yeah, at one point while I was working on it, I kind of said to her that that for some reason it wasn't hitting me as hard. Like, I would write some things and it would be a little bit emotional, but it was like, I was kind of going, I feel like there should be more emotion here. I feel like I should be feeling more. I'm putting the emotion on the page, but I'm feeling something, but I feel like I should feel something more because what these people went through is some of it in particular is really horrendous. Like, everything we've heard from the soldier's point of view is nothing compared to what the boat people went through as they tried to get out. I mean, it was like around a million dead or something like that, and just the horrors as they tried to escape. But, and this is the part that may be a little TMI, but Basically, when I got done with the book, I finished it in the middle of the night. Everybody was asleep, and I literally pushed save, and it was like all that emotion had been held up inside. I didn't even realize where it was, and suddenly I realized that I had subconsciously been holding it in to get the book done, and I lost it. I just broke down crying. Everything that had happened, like every story I had heard, every bit of information, just all hit me at once, and I just absolutely toppled over crying my eyes out for close to an hour.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was your fault.
Yes, exactly. All of it.
Right. I mean, all of it's your fault. We know all these bad things are... We just go, it's Jeff. Yeah, he does it.
And they're all pointing their fingers at me.
That's right. Don't let him loose. Keep him tight.
Yes.
Oh, wow. So it does change a person. I know a lot of my books have. Some of them haven't, but some do. You know, it's just, I guess it's probably because when you meet people that tell you the story, when you see them live, I think that's probably more effective than when you just read about it in a paper.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I mean, and that's sort of part of what all hit me at once, because there's something about when I'm interviewing, there's, you know, part of it is like realizing what I'm hearing, but at the same time, there's also somewhat of a, you don't realize history while you're living through it in a way, you know? And so talking to people that, I mean, and also there's a sort of the aspect of me trying to think of how am I going to collect this information and form, you know, format it and stuff like that. So there's a part of me that can't completely be as present as I, you know, could be. But actually, it's somewhat of a good thing, because sometimes with these stories, I'd probably break down crying and never be able to write anything down. But yeah, I grab all of it into my mind, and then, yeah, at the end, particularly in this case, it was the, you know, just seeing all the faces again in my mind's eye, you know, and it was as if I was back there hearing their stories, and this time I was finally able to allow it out loud. On a more positive side, actually, with the other book, Two Gun Heart, you were talking about, that one had a more uplifting one in that, because basically after Al died and after the mother died and after Richard died, or Vincenzo, the oldest brother, after they all died, basically the family kind of split apart, particularly because people kept telling the story of Al and what a criminal he was, and a lot of people started feeling a lot of shame for being a Capone. And so there was very much of a, you know, splitting of the family. But then as this book started to get written, more and more of the family started hearing, hey, somebody's doing something about a positive aspect of our family. And so they started giving little bits and pieces of information. And I started getting some things about the family that nobody's ever had before for a book, and certain pictures, certain photos in the book that have never been published before. And I got some advice from everybody, including Al's own granddaughter, and started hearing like little bits and pieces. And then, and I started hearing that the family was talking again more and more. And one of the most exciting things that I saw on my Facebook feed, because I became friends with a lot of them, was at some point, you know, paging through various different posts and then come upon a picture of them in Italy, all sitting with a bunch of people I didn't know. And I read the captions, and it's the first time that the Capone family had ever gone back to Italy, and they're meeting with the Capone family that's still there, because there's, of course, still Capones that are still there. And they met up for the first time in over 100 years, and they're having dinner together, and they'd gone there because they were doing research for this book. But while there, they reconnected. So this was the Capone family reconnecting with each other. And that's one of those things where it's just like, it's, you know, I don't even know where to put it. It was such a, it made me cry in the other direction, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, so. It's interesting because the, kind of shows human nature, but because Al Capone is the most popular because of the bad things, right?
Right.
And that's who we kind of, focus on more so than, let's say, someone that did something a little bit more positive. Why were they so different, these two brothers, when they're in the same family and, you know, growing up together, and they ended up kind of taking different directions?
You know, yeah, that's a good question, because you would think that's the obvious difference between them is, of course, one being on the side of the law and one being a criminal. But the in many ways, actually, they were very, very similar in terms of they were both so ambitious. they just were ambitious in whatever direction they happened to be going. And really, when it comes right down to it, I don't think either of them chose their path, per se. It was more like, I mean, Richard chose his path more. And by the way, I should explain to the audience, his birth name was Vincenzo, Vincenzo Capone. But then after he ran away from home as a teenager, he changed his name a couple times, ended up settling on Richard Hart, not because the Capone name was so infamous, because it wasn't yet. It's just purely because there was so much hate, so much bigotry against Italian Americans, that he didn't want anybody to know he was Italian. So he changed his name to Richard Hart, and Hart came after a movie star that existed that was big at the time, William S. Hart. Anyway, so Richard, yes, he chose to go run away from home. Yes, he chose to join the army and then wound up becoming a lawman. But it was mostly because he wanted to be like the heroes in the movies. So if he happened to be watching gangster movies, he probably would have gone in that direction. If he would have been watching, it was just purely he wanted to live that fantasy that he saw, on the screen, and he went at it after it with full gusto. With Al, if you've ever seen the movie Gangs of New York, that neighborhood is where they were growing up. And so the Five Points Gang was really where he was growing up, really was what he was surrounded by. And so that's sort of the community he grew up in. He actually, after he got married, he tried to pull out of the whole thing. In fact, I think the line, every time I tried to get out, they pull me back in. I think that was inspired by Al, by Al Capone, because I know the writer was inspired by all that. But anyway, he basically tried to leave, but his father died, and in the Italian tradition, the oldest brother would usually take over for the family. And it wasn't, because there was a lot of sexism, the mother would not be able to care for the family, so you'd have the oldest brother would sort of take the role of the father and take care of the family. But the oldest brother was Richard, was Vincenzo, who had run away from home. Then there were two other brothers who were in and out of prison all the time, so Al was kind of the first in line that was responsible enough to do something, but he couldn't, he could not take care of the whole family, because there were several other family members as well. He really could not take care of them and his own family on the income he currently had. So, but meanwhile, this guy, Johnny Turio, was setting up some things in Chicago, and that's when Al was like, okay, I'll take this job so that I can, take care of my family. And the rest is history. And the thing is, Al went over there, and he was just, in anything, Al went all the way. Like, regardless of the job, he could be, if somebody had made him a police. In fact, somebody even pointed that out. There was a military guy who saw him one time at the Navy Yards, and when Al was a little kid, and this guy saw little young Al Capone shouting at some people, and he said, that kid is going to make something of himself one day, and if a wise guy gets hold of him, it's going to be trouble. I don't forget the exact line, but it's something of that nature. He basically said somebody's got to guide this guy, because this guy is full bore whatever direction he goes in. And it's just the gangster got to him first. It's part of the problem with society is when you push aside a certain group of people, there's going to be somebody among them who's a genius and who goes full bore into whatever he goes into. And if all he has is gangsters, that's what he's going to become good at. And that's exactly what happened with Al Capone. So the two were just both very, very much going full gusto into whatever they did. That's just the path they were on. So
I have to wonder about how they got along, because I'm thinking that there's also something different in the character, because, Richard, he was like, when the alcohol was illegal and the production of it, he was an enforcement of that. So, and meanwhile, Al Capone, loved his liquor. So I just wonder, did they get along being so different?
Well, when Richard left, or Vincenzo left and went off to become Richard Hart, he disappeared from the family for many years. And there was no, for a long time, it was a mystery as to when exactly he came back and reconnected with the family. My belief was that it was in 1924 when Al happened to become basically being in charge of the rackets, because there was a newspaper reporter who later stated that he saw the two together, and basically the two of them agreed to stay out of each other's territory. And I believe that was basically when Richard went back to Al and said, hey, stay out of Nebraska, I'll stay out of Chicago, kind of a thing. Interestingly enough, it seems from that guy's statements and from from a number of others later on, that Al was very gregarious, was very excited about seeing his brother again, which actually makes sense because when they were kids, Richard or Vincenzo would take Al to Staten Island where there were horses, and he would take him, or they had, there was like this horse stables, and he would take Al horseback riding. And Al, as a little kid, just loved it. He was apparently very heartbroken when Richard disappeared because that was sort of like his favorite thing to do, was just sort of escape from the constant gangland violence he was used to seeing. And so when he reconnected with him, he was so excited, but apparently Richard was much more standoffish, was much more of like, well, you're a gangster, I'm a, you know, and he had really defined himself by that hero character of, you know, I'm the hero, you're the villain. And that, once again, kind of apparently, it seems to have broken Al's heart, but eventually the BIA and the Office of Prohibition, all of them, turned their back on Richard, and he had nowhere to turn but to go back to the family. He didn't become a gangster with them or anything like that, but they basically helped take care of him. They welcomed him back with open arms. And apparently, yeah, Al was always just like, my brother, I want you back, kind of a thing.
Did he dislike what Al did? Did he like his, his whole gangster thing and all this stuff? Were they able to kind of get along in that way, or did he just, Richard, sort of stay away from it, or what do you think happened there?
I get the idea. Now, it is one thing. Some of it is semi-speculation because this is a family that was all about secrets. In fact, Richard kept his own heritage secret from his own family. His own family did not know until, what was it, the 1940s, I think, that they were, you know, that they were related to this very, very infamous family. There's no definitive information except for like little bits and pieces of like witness accounts here and there. And, like for instance, they would meet on the, Indian reservations, and a lot of the natives would have later say, we saw Al Capone talking with our prohibition officer, you know, our BIA agent, on the reservation. We couldn't understand why until later. I get the idea that it was, that he was still friendly with them, that he was friendly with them, but it was because of the fact that he kept meeting with them. But I also get the idea that that he still saw him kind of as, you know, as the bad guy, the guy who's doing. And it really was sort of, Richard had somewhat of a black and white view because of the fact that he was so much into the whole idea of he threw himself into the role of what he had seen as the cowboy. You know what I mean? And he even wore cowboy outfits, like full head to toe, had two six shooters at his side, rode a horse, even though it was the 1920s. And so you get the idea that this was a guy who just sort of wanted to be the cowboy from the movies. And then when he saw his brother this way, he didn't react very, happily to him. And you get that sense from the fact that he kind of kept pushing him away, but Al kept coming to visit him. But later on, he then opened up a bit once his own offices had really turned their backs on him.
Do you know why Richard left home?
You know, that's the big mystery that to this day has never been found out. We've always wanted to know. We've always tried to understand. I would ask Harry about, like, Harry was, you know, like I say, he was always wanting his father's story to be told, but I would ask him some of these personal things, and he would shrug, like, why should I know that? And I'm like, but you're the one wanting his story told. But yeah, that's the thing, is he said, you know, you never think to ask your father these things. And his father died when he was 60. So, you know, he was pretty young, and by the, you know, a lot of us, we don't think to ask our parents about these amazing stories until they're a little bit older. And so he never really thought to ask him some of these questions, didn't really get to know what his mother was like, you know, personally. So some of those aspects he never got to, and now he's, I shouldn't say now, he became curious as we were writing the book. Unfortunately, Harry's passed away by now, but while we were writing the book, Harry was like, I really wish I had asked him why he left home, because he probably would have just answered, but it's just nobody ever up. And now you look at it, and it's like there really doesn't seem to be any reason why he would leave, except, I mean, we kind of got the idea because there was a show called the 101 Wild West Show that had that William S. Hart was in charge of, and it happened to be in Staten Island at that time. And it left right when Richard left. And the next time he appears, he's in Oklahoma in the One Wild West Show. So I kind of get the idea probably he was there maybe riding the horses or something. Somebody said, probably said, hey, we're going to do this show. If you want to come, you'd have to come like right now. And it was probably one of those things where it was just like, I either take the opportunity right now or I have to lose it forever. He apparently knew he was going because Al was walking with him down to the docks that day. And Richard said to him, not today, Al, today you're staying behind. And the last time Al saw him for decades then was Richard getting onto the ferry and just disappearing into the distance.
Have you met Deidre Capone or talked to her?
Yeah, she consulted with me a bit on this.
Yeah, well, she's been on the show a few times. And she sort of has, I would say in my eyes, that she was pretty, she idolized Al Capone.
Yeah.
She doesn't think he's really been was a bad person, was part of any of the crimes, like Valentine's Day Massacre and stuff like that, which, I understand, because to her she was a little girl and he was probably a great uncle, you know, buying her a bike and toys and mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing. What's your feeling on that? Was Al Capone as bad as they say?
So probably the best quote I ever heard on this was when we were first my father and I were first meeting Harry, and I remember very vividly, he had a trunk that was bigger than him, and he was moving some things into it, he was opening it up, and we asked him what he thought of his uncle, and he leaned on it, and he says, you know, my uncle is no angel, but he's been very misunderstood. And I think that quote, the more I learned about him, the more I feel that one quote nails it right on the head, because no, he was not innocent of a lot of things. He did do a lot of really horrible things. And I think that, it's difficult in our culture, particularly the American culture, to be able to look at someone like Al Capone, because we tend to look at things as all one way or all the other. And he is the definition of shades of gray. Some of the things he did were really horrible. But then there were some times where he was really taking care of the Italian American community. And really, in many ways, his life was kind of decided for him. It was, like I was saying earlier, he tried to kind of get out of that life, but he kept getting shoved into it. And his life was basically as a result of the terrible way that Italian Americans were treated at that time. I certainly wouldn't want to excuse him. This is what I mean by it's like hard for our culture to understand him, because on the one hand, I want to say, hey, he's not as bad as you guys say, but then it starts sounding like I'm excusing him and saying, no, he was, he was an angel. He never did. He was a Robin Hood. He never did anything. It's like, no, he still did these terrible things. And then it starts sounding like, oh, it was reprehensible. There's no positive side or whatever. And it's like, well, no, he was somebody who got stuck in a certain path, did some really bad things, but he was also doing, basically navigating as best he could through life and trying to help his community, and kind of had a mentality of the rest of the world kind of go to hell, because that's what the rest of the world was doing to him and his family for so long. It was very much of like, we got ours, you all can go to hell. So once he got his, he was like, we're getting ours, you all can go to hell. So it's a lot of shades of gray, in my opinion.
Yeah, he was into S&M then. That's what you're saying. We get it. That's what the the young guys listening will be going, oh yeah, I know what this is about. So why did Richard Hart leave the law enforcement? You kind of touched off on saying that he was kind of they turned their back on him. So yeah. what happened there?
Well, he he was so much into doing the right thing that he sometimes didn't play the game. First of all, actually, he switched. He was initially a prohibition officer, and he switched from that to the BIA. And the reason was because he kept seeing all this corruption. I mean, that's one thing we always learn about when we learn about prohibition, was how much the Office of Prohibition was corrupt and how much the law enforcement, particularly of the liquor laws, was itself corrupt. And he was somebody who could, he was truly untouchable. He could not be bought off. He was all about... because he defined himself completely as the hero, as this cowboy who rides into town, everything. So for him, it didn't matter how much you paid.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
That wasn't, you know, that it went against his definition, the definition of his personality. One of the best stories was at one point he actually was driving a car because he had captured somebody. He's trying to drive home. He gets lost in the rain and winds up in the wrong town in this small, you know, Nebraska. That can happen. You get on the wrong road when it's raining. But rather than just turning around and going wherever he's supposed to go, he just finds out where's the closest, who's selling liquor in town. So he finds out who he is, punches the guy, knocks him unconscious, puts him in the back of the car, drives both of these guys to the sheriff's office. And he says, where's the sheriff? Or where's the local sheriff? I've got this guy who's selling liquor. And the deputy's there, points at the guy who he just knocked out, and is like, that's the sheriff. So he started seeing more and more of that sort of corruption, and it kept getting kind of worse and worse. So he ended up leaving the Office of Prohibition, became a BIA agent, which is Bureau of Indian Affairs, started working with the natives. He would learn their culture, learn their language. He just, every job he went into, he just completely dove into it. And the job kept moving him further and further west to different reservations. And then finally, he sees this one superintendent he's working for who was corrupt himself. He was taking bribes and all that sort of thing. And he pointed it out. And rather than the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington going, hey, all right, got, you know, one of our guys, we're going to get rid of him, they instead turned on him and was and allowed the superintendent he was pointing out fire him. He ended up wound up with his family literally homeless, living down by the river in a shack down by the river. Superintendent was later on became so corrupt that he ended up having to flee with his mistress down to Mexico. So Richard was right about that, and he tried to get back into the BIA, but they still wouldn't let him, even though he was proven right. And so when he was literally, to eat, just to have sustenance, he was catching fish in the river. And that was how he was feeding his family. And as winter started to, and he was still stubborn. He's just like, no, I'm not going to, I'm not going to go corrupt. I'm not going to do anything that breaks my moral code or whatever, until winter was starting to set in. And if you've ever seen a winter in Nebraska, it's really cold. And he was afraid for his family. So that's when he finally went back to the Capone family. And then he came back from Chicago with like a nice new suit and literally a handful of cash.
So what do you hope people take away from the book?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, for me, first and foremost, I was just like, this is a really fascinating story. I'd like you to learn from it. But of course, every time that I write a book, I then end up being fulfilled with something and, learning something from it. I think a big part of it, I hate to make it about Al because it's really, this is supposed to be a book about Richard and the things he did right. But also just how people wind up, and I guess this goes for both of them, him and Al, because it's very much of a story of that brotherhood, how somebody winds up getting into a certain path in life and, you know, goes down that direction, and to sort of understand not just where they are on the path, but where that path comes from. Also, there's a lot of, I want people to understand about, the Italian American community as well. I mean, one thing that I wanted to publish this traditionally, but I could not get this published traditionally through a regular publisher. But the reason was that was always given to me was, well, this is about an Italian American who's not a gangster, so we don't want to publish it. So that's why I ended up independently publishing, was literally because of the very bigotry that caused Al to become a gangster to begin with. And so now it feels so good. There are several people who have come to me as Italian saying, this book has helped me feel some pride in my community, whereas because every book comes out, it's either about Al or about some other Italian American gangster. And for once, here's something that, you know, there's a hero. And I didn't understand when I started this book, I didn't understand why this story hadn't been published yet. And then after trying to get it published with the traditional publishers, I found out why it hadn't, because they're stuck in this mentality, the very mentality that caused all this to begin with, which was, you know, well, they're all gangsters, so, you know, we're just going to perpetuate the stereotype. So I'd like to help break that stereotype, if you will. Yes. Yes. Oh, and the way that was found, because we knew that he had met her, because basically what we'd known was there was a flood. He went and he rescued her from that flood. And then they were married within a few months, which is like, you know, such a standard, Western kind of story. Then one day, Corey, who is the great grandson of Richard, he found this article that told the story in detail, and I couldn't believe it. He sent it to me. So he had gone out with them, and I think he was dating Kathleen at the time. He was with her mother, and her brother. And they're driving back home. It started to rain. They find this little girl along the road, so she jumps in with them, and they're continuing on. But the rains come down so hard, and there are nearby creeks. They overfill, and it starts to flood. And the car gets picked up and starts to float away. And so the mother tries to sort of stop. She gets her foot out there and tries to stop the car from, you know, drifting. She gets swept away. The brother jumps in to try to help her. He gets swept away another way. The little girl, just for good measure, she falls out, goes a different way. And so Richard jumps out, saves the little girl, takes her to a hill, swims out there, saves the brother, saves the mother, then grabs the car and drags it to the hill. And needless to say, Kathleen was impressed and married him a couple months later.
Your newest book, I should say now, is Dirty Old War, and that's The Tales of Vietnam. And we touched off on that. So what was the purpose of this? Like, what is it that you hope to come up with for people when they read it?
You know, what I would really like people to see is various perspectives, both about this war and in general. I think there's a difficulty in our culture to understand other perspectives. And one of the things that is particularly, as I wrote this book, one thing that kind of started infuriating me more and more is the impression that we've always gotten either completely one impression or completely the other, especially with the Vietnam War. I think one of the biggest things about the Vietnam War from the American perspective is that our culture changed. We went from being a very propagandist sort of, you know, like you look at the newsreels at the beginning of the war and it's on the march. Da-da-da-da-da. We're doing the right thing. Everything's perfect because America does all of these perfect things. By the end of the war, it's completely reversed the other way. And it's like American can do no right. Everything we do is garbage. We're horrible people. And, you know, this whole thing was a terrible thing. We never should have been helping the South Vietnamese. And I know a lot of these people from South Vietnam, and it's really an insult to them to be like, no, this is a waste. We never should have helped. It's like we went to help a group of people, and yes, we did everything. We did a lot of things wrong. Like most of the things we did wrong, we did wrong. But the very act of trying to help a group of people was not in itself wrong, especially when you find out a lot of the things that the North Vietnamese did once they took, America kind of forgets about Vietnam. Once we went out, oh, it's like it stopped to exist. No, the North Vietnamese went in there and slaughtered tons and tons of people. Khmer Rouge, while they weren't in Vietnam, they were right next door. And that's when you look at what the horrible things they did, you understand that kind of all came from the same area and mentality. And you can get an idea of just what horrible things people had to go through. I've talked to some of the survivors, people who came out of that and witnessed for themselves some of the horrible things that happened. So to say it's all one way or all the other is a complete fallacy. What I'm hoping is not that people come out going, it was right for us to go in there, or that it was wrong for us to go in there, but rather to understand the various perspectives and understand that this was so much more complicated. And to understand, you know, like if somebody's, you know, total pro-war, we were doing the right thing, to understand from the perspective of somebody who lost everything because because they were forced to go in there when it wasn't something they should be involved in at all. But if somebody's completely anti-war, against that war, to understand the perspective of a South Vietnamese person who was literally rescued because some of our people went in there and helped them, you know, get out. There's so much more to the story. And because typically when books are written and moves are made, it's all one way. We're totally justified, or all the other. We're completely in the wrong. And no, the Vietnam War is absolutely one of the most complex things that you could possibly study.
Oh, I'd imagine, you know, you see it from all sides, but I would think that this would be a little bit controversial in a way. Yeah. To kind of talk about this, because you're right, when you're within the border walls of the U.S., and you even look at the movies and everything, it's almost like a propaganda in a sense. It's all, you know, the freedom and all this stuff that the U.S. has gone to war for. So you do only get one side. If you go to Vietnam, it's totally a different point of view there, because they were there, they lived it.
You know, and also actually one thing I probably should have led with this as well, because my book Dirty Old War is not a political piece. It is not about the big picture, whether it was right or wrong, we went in or anything like that. It's completely and 100% just the stories. And I try to be as objective as possible. Just go, here's this person's story. Here's what they went through. Here's this person's story. Here's what they went through, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't want to tell people what to think. I want people just to see the various perspectives. So more than anything, I want them to come back with those perspectives, but I want them to understand those various perspectives tell different parts of it. I don't want people to look at, because people do have a tendency of looking at just what matches their preconceived notions. It's like, I already believe this way, and see, this proves me right. Then they'll ignore the next part, which points out some things they may not want to hear. I want people to listen to every part, the parts they may agree with and the parts they may disagree with and the parts they just didn't know. To me, that's more important than anything.
Yeah, you know, it's not very political in the U.S. right now, so.
It never is.
You know, yeah. It might help them to get on board, start thinking about politics for a change.
Yeah.
No, I know what you're saying. So basically, you're just telling the story from a human perspective. It's like, this is what it was like for me. This is what it was like for us, like the people you're talking to. So, you know, there's it's not really about politics in that case. It's just a personal story.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's really all history is a lot of different perspectives. So, you know, even when you're talking about a war between, you know, a million people on each side, it's a million different stories. And each one of them together brings together the one story.
What do you think the most surprising of the stories was for you? Like from what you had as a perspective of living and being born in the U.S. and all that stuff, and then what you know, and then once you've talked to people, what was different?
That is a really good question. I'd say, I mean, obviously, anything in South Vietnam, like just how bad things got after the North Vietnam, like I expected it to be bad. Like it's, you know, it's going to be an adjustment of the new government. I didn't expect the slaughter that happened. I didn't expect, I mean, like that friend of mine, or the royal, member of the royal family, the ones who were caught just because they were descendants of a royal family that had wasn't even, that had abdicated the throne even, just the fact of their lineage, they were buried alive. And that was how they died, was smothering in that way. You know, although I was also then, it was fascinating. Actually, you know, probably one of the biggest surprises was then learning the history, because through that, I then went back and like learned the history of this royal family. And that, of course, then was part and parcel with the history of Vietnam and how you always hear about this rivalry or the troubles they've had go back, you know, a long time. But so it's not that a surprise to learn that these things went back a long time. It was just a surprise to learn the details about them, about how there had always been like this struggle between various groups of people in the North and in the South. The country Vietnam literally means North and the South, or I mean, Viet was, I think it's Viet was South and Nam was North or something like that, or it was the regions that were there. And so the name of that country is literally unity of the North and the South. And so when you understand that one thing, the very fact that the literal country name is unity, you can understand then why there's so much of a push that we want to be together. And not everybody felt that way, of course, but there, you know, I came to understand why there were people who were so obsessed with that. Then of course, yeah, a lot of what happened after we left, because of course we, you know, there's this attitude in the U.S. of once we left, everything was good. It was all, you know, and it's funny because that side of the political coin usually thinks of themselves as being caring of others. Because look how caring we are, because we brought the soldiers back, but it's like, yeah, but in so doing, you've completely ignored the fact that all these people are going to be slaughtered. And it was just sort of the selfishness of, we're just going to ignore the fact that all these people are now going to go through, you know, terrible hell. So yeah, that was very fascinating. And also, oddly enough, some of the stories of American soldiers were some of the most surprising, which you wouldn't think, because it's like, well, we've heard American soldier stories all the time. But there are some of these stories that you wouldn't, they're just so bizarre. You would think, oh, well, why didn't I hear about that type of thing before? Like, for instance, one of them, he's talking about when his unit was out there in the middle of the jungle, just no civilization anywhere. And then they come up on this trail and there is a table set up that looks like it's straight out of a palace. I mean, straight out of like Louis the 14th, you know, like the finest dining, and the food was hot. Like they had just served it. And it belonged out of a castle, but somebody had schlepped all this long, beautiful table, the tablecloth, the chairs, everything, and just placed it right out there in the middle of the jungle somewhere. It's weird stories like that that I, you know, were just so surprising and so odd.
Like when you cover something like this, do you ever get the feeling that, you know, the old saying that history repeats itself when we don't remember? Does that mean more to you now?
Yeah, well, in fact, the spoiler alert, the very last line is that. That was exactly why I chose that particular story. There's a guy named Glenn, it's an American Marine. And I chose to have his story last specifically because one of his quotes was, after that, after Vietnam, he became a nurse. He was a Marine pilot during Vietnam, but then he became a nurse and he was involved in, I believe it was the first Gulf War. And as he saw things starting and there being a lot of chaos and all that sort of thing, his first thought was, where have I seen this before? And that's the last line of the book. Because, it's as long as we don't understand shades of gray, we will get ourselves into these things over and over and over again. And I don't, you know, it's like a lot of people, I mean, I consider myself more politically left, but one thing that I get frustrated by is a lot of times on the left, my fellow, you know, a lot of my friends will think that, yeah, you know, we'll by just thinking this way, we'll avoid that sort of thing. It's like, even just thinking completely on that side, you're not avoiding these things happening, because anytime that you think purely black and white, purely one way or the other, these sort of things are going to happen. What people need to understand is that there are always shades of gray.
Yeah.
I guess that's the theme of today. There's always shades of gray. And it helps to when you see all the different perspectives,
absolutely,
that's when you understand how much everything is in shades of gray. So.
Yeah. I think I worry more because each generation that comes up, And, you know, even I can relate to myself coming up in the 60s and 70s and thinking that you know it all, but you don't. And there's a lot that you don't get because you don't experience it. So, you know, you hear a lot of people complain about different things in today's state, but they, you know, they're missing what really, where it all came from.
Yeah.
And I think that's a problem, you know.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I mean, I sometimes feel bad about some of the points of view I have, because, like, if I was of age at that, I mean, I was born right when Vietnam was sort of coming to a close. But, you know, if I was of age at that time, I certainly wouldn't have wanted to have to, you know, get everything on and go over there and have to fight and all that sort of thing. So who am I to say, you know, that some of the things we were doing was occasionally the right thing? I mean, ultimately, like I say, it's very complicated, and there's, you know, there are some wrong things, some right things, that sort of thing. But if I'm going to say, hey, you know, some of what they were doing was saving people, who am I to say that if I myself wouldn't have wanted to go over there? But to me, what's more important in today's, looking back is simply to understand that those people who did go over there to act like, oh, it was a waste what you guys went and did, that's a very unkind way of looking at it. You know, it's like, because a lot of them, their friends died for something. And it's like, it's better to understand there was, you know, even though the U.S. did mess a lot of things up, and there was a lot of problems with that war, to look at it purely from it was a waste is really, it's rude to a lot of the veterans who gave so much and some everything. And it's rude to some of the South Vietnamese who were rescued from, you know, some of the situation and all sort of things. So I certainly don't want to come across sounding pro-war, but at the same time, I also think it's wrong to look at it just purely from, oh, it's a waste, and make people feel like what they sacrificed was for nothing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's important that, you know, the biggest problem with today is there's that generalization of, you know, even when you say left and further left and right, you're just generalizing right, sure. People. And even with war, right, to say right or wrong, I think it's individual. I think there were people that did things for the wrong reason, and there are people that did things for the right reason. And I think you get a mix of all of that in there, you know, because you have a lot of hands in when you get into a war like Vietnam, a lot of government and military, and then there's so many people involved that have an influence on what goes on. When you come down to the very bottom of it, all that really matters is the personal experience and what people took away, you know, what they were left with. I mean, that war touched a lot of people. You know, I remember seeing things, people that were injured or hurt and coming back from that war, soldiers, and how they were, you know, spit on, and how, you know, there were so many things. But, you know, without even taking about a blame or a big picture, you just look at it individually, you know, two people that were doing something for different reasons, and yet how there's a conflict over it, it's a really tough thing. I don't think there's a real good answer to it. There's just, you have to experience living through it, I think, to understand the influence it has on each person, rather than, you know, blaming a president or blaming a military person or any of that stuff. It's much deeper.
Right, exactly. And that's why, yeah, I kind of stammered going through this, because of the fact that it's like, it is so difficult to say, like, World War II, you can easily say, yes, we needed to go there. You know, Korea, well, you know, you like it, whether it was coming out of South Korea nowadays, you know, you need to be there. Vietnam, if I'm sounding like, you know, yes, it was right for us to go there, that, no, not so fast. I don't mean that either. It is just so complicated. I so often hear, you know, so much of one way or the other of like, oh, it was all a waste, or oh, it was all good. And it's like, nah, it was, it's way more complicated. And just like you say, it's the individual stories. And actually, you touched on one thing that I should have said, this is one of the things that surprised me the most. When soldiers were brought back and when refugees were brought back, the soldiers were brought back through San Francisco. the Vietnamese refugees were brought back to Alabama. Like, what? How does that make sense? When I looked at that, I was like, whoever did that either was a major practical joker or does not understand American culture.
Or they did, but they wanted an outcome. You know, that's kind of, I think that's kind of where people get mixed up because, you know, they, you know, you can look at Jane Fonda and the controversy she had, and there's people that still hate her to this day, but then there's people that think she did, was amazing. And I just, and I look at these things and I think, well, how can you hate someone you don't know or love someone? You just got to look at them as they made a personal choice at the time, just like soldiers that went, just like everything, or to blame Nixon or to blame, there's so many things that people like to, I guess it's easier to wrap it up and just blame that person. It's all that person's fault, and it makes it easier, but there's so many angles. And I think that's the important thing of the book. I think the book's showing, you know, just the people that are living through all of these choices that have been made by governments and military and stuff, and what the effect is on their life. And I think that's the important part.
Yeah. Oh, and ironically, I've actually met Jane Fonda. I didn't talk to her about this, but she's a complex, just like you say, she's a complex person, as all people are. And, you know, people look at this one moment in history where she may have said the wrong things and all that, but certainly that's many years ago. And the way she is now is a much more complex person. Sees issues in general from various points of view.
Yeah. I just can't look back and hate someone from 50 years or 60 years ago or whatever for something, choices people were making because they thought they were doing the right thing.
Right.
I just kind of look at, well, you know, it's easy to look back and kind of go, oh, well, you shouldn't have done this. Yeah.
Well, people evolve. And also, even from looking at that point of view, at that time, if one looks at it from her point of view, you may still disagree with it, but you can see where somebody was coming from. It's again where this war is so complex. It's when you completely look at it from the point of view of someone like her, you can see the frustration. It's like, you know, hell with this. These people need to stop being bombed. You look at it from a, you know, Vietnamese point of view, and the fact that they're like, look, our name literally means unity. We should be together. But you look at it from a South Vietnamese point of view, and it's like, I just want to live, and I don't want to be, you know, massacred by these, and I don't want somebody, you know, the communists to be looking over my shoulder and telling me what I can and can't do every day. And then you look at it from an American soldier who's like, look, I had dreams. I don't want to go over to this tiny little country and, you know, do these things. But then they get there and they see some wrongs happening and they help them. You know, they do their best to try to, you know, help whoever they see, and they come back and they're spit on and called baby killers. So it's all these different perspectives, which makes it very fascinating. But people need to have humanity and start understanding.
Yeah.
It's different points of view.
Oh, for sure. So. Yeah, it's just one of those things. It's very, very difficult. But we're glad we have people like you writing then.
Thank you. Thank you.
So now you have a website or a place that you like people to come and send you dirty letters and attack you?
Yes, it's bandwagononline.com. It's basically my independent publishing, you know, wing. That's where I have all my stuff. I'm actually have a book coming out. The third part of the serial comes out, 2 days? Yeah, that's right. It's, 3 days, April 1st, called Relic Worlds, which is basically like Indiana Jones, but in space. You can find all my books there, nonfiction, fiction, all that on bandwagononline.com.
And, Shades of Grey, right?
Yes, I'm very much all shades of gray.
Ah, yeah. So
if you but not 50 shades of gray. No.
Yeah, if you want to see, Jeff's 50 shades, just go to his website and he's there for you.
I'm looking at it right now, and like one of my covers has sort of a sexy look, and it's like, oh man, if they go there expecting that, they're going to be very disappointed because it's actually a look at the at prostitution and some of the difficult lives of a lot of these prostitutes. So it's like, yeah, no, you're not going to get sexy 50 Shades of Grey or whatever.
Oh, well, anyway. Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for being on the show, and We'll have all that up on our website. So our guest has been Jeff MacArthur.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.